Yes, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's event. Mr. Nachon, welcome to the Hertie School. Mr. van Esveld, welcome. And of course, our dear friend and colleague, Mr. Michalski, welcome back to the Hertie School. This is the fourth event in our series with Human Rights Watch. The title of the series is Human Rights in a Globalized World. It's done in cooperation with Human Rights Watch, and it is also recorded by National Public Radio. So if you ask questions later on, please make sure that you walk up to microphone and that we can probably record your questions. Tonight's lecture will be on human rights in conflict zones, how to protect human rights in conflict zones such as Israel and Gaza, a very, very topical issue. One that has been with the world for quite some time, and I think that in the events of the last couple of weeks assumes new relevance. And I will leave it, I think, to Mr. Michalski, our chair tonight, to introduce the panel. And I think I wish us a very good conversation tonight and new insights into what is happening to human rights in conflict zones. Thanks so much. Welcome again, Mr. Michalski.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The situation in the Middle East and in North Africa has changed dramatically since my predecessor, Marianne Heuwagen, Hertie School of Governance and the Berlin Committee organized these monthly lecture series a year or so ago. This was the reason why in February we changed the subject of the panel, which was human rights and business in Russia, and which we'll discuss on April the 14th, so please come and join us again. Last time, we talked about the current situation in the Middle East and North Africa and the ripple effect instead. We talked mainly about Egypt, Yemen, and Tunisia. This was 1 month ago, just 1 month ago, and shows us how fast and dramatically the situation has changed even since then, and how completely different it is now. Let me just mention the terrible civil war in Libya and the state of emergency in Bahrain. The title of today's panel, How to Protect Human Rights in Conflict Zones Such as Israel and Gaza, is 1 year old and sounds slightly out of touch now as the whole region is a conflict zone. The conflicts are complex and multi-layered. Let's discuss today the effect of these fundamental changes on the political and human rights situation in Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. And I'm sure we're going to have an extremely lively discussion today. And I'm very pleased that we have two excellent experts on board. Emmanuel Nachon is the minister of the Israeli embassy here in Berlin. He was born in Paris and served many years already as a diplomat for Israel in Caracas, Brussels, and Ankara. Bill van Esveld is a researcher for Human Rights Watch based in Jerusalem. He reported extensively on human rights and laws of war violations by Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, as well as by Israeli forces. One more word before I start. In our brochure, you find Human Rights Watch's Emergencies Director, Peter Buchert, as one of the panelists. He couldn't come today as he is extremely busy in North Africa researching and documenting the situation there. So he is excused, I think. Let's first hear the views of the two gentlemen, and then after a short discussion on the panel, I would like to open the floor so you have the chance and enough time for comments and questions. So please, gentlemen, come and join me. And why don't we start with you, Emmanuel?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the invitation and for the occasion to talk to you and to present a little bit my perspectives on the issues of human rights, generally speaking, and also particularly in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict context, because I think that this is of particular importance and interest. Of course, the views that I will express are an Israeli perspective, but whenever it's my own personal view, I will tell you, because I think that it's important in those issues not only to present an official perspective, but also to give a personal insight into those particular issues. In September, we are all going to remember the 9/11 attacks in New York and in the United States, which, in a perspective now of 10 years or almost 10 years back, were certainly a world-changing event. Our perspectives on the world, our perspectives on ourselves as modern and democratic societies totally changed after 9/11, because we suddenly realized, or we suddenly understood, that conflicts were no longer limited to war zones, and conflicts were no longer fought between soldiers of opposing nations. The whole globe had become a battlefield in which the instruments and the weapons were no longer classical war weapons. It is a war which is waged not necessarily with airplanes and tanks and rifles, but mostly with the impact on public opinion and with the impact on the daily life of people. This discovery of the world after 9/11 was something which had been quite well known in the Israeli context for many, many years, because we have been facing a situation which is not entirely dissimilar since the creation of the State of Israel. In parallel to classical conflicts that we have had in the region, such as the Six Days War, the Yom Kippur War, or other classical wars, we have been facing a situation of permanent terror whose purpose was to send a message to the government by harming the civilian population, to create a climate which would have an influence on the decision-making process, to create a climate which would send a message which goes beyond the military, which sends an immediate, violent, brutal message to the population. The latest example, by the way, was the slaughtering of a family last Friday, when a person decides that it is a good idea to take a knife and to butcher a 3-month-old baby. The message is quite clear. Now, can we discuss with the people who are behind the messenger and reach peace with them? This is a big question. But it's obvious that there is a very clear message which is directed at the civilian population. And this is something that we know now in the whole world. And this is the basis also for the big dilemmas that we are facing in terms of human rights in a conflict zone, particularly in Israel and in the Israeli-Palestinian context. Those dilemmas have been followed in Israel for many, many years, of course, by the political class, by the general public, and also by the Israeli Supreme Court, which has given us guidelines in terms of how does it work, how do you maintain human rights in a situation of conflict. In parentheses, this is a subject in which we are engaged also in intense discussions with the German Bundesverfassungsgericht, because this concerns also Germany. The questions that we are facing concern each and every one of you, because those are questions that have to do with the infringement or the possible infringement on human rights or civilian rights in order to protect the general society. And those are questions which challenge us all. We are in a particular situation in Israel because since 1967, we are in a situation of occupation. We occupy territories which do not form part of the State of Israel. But one should not forget that terror started long before the occupation. And terror started long before the building of settlements. We have been fighting or facing Palestinian and Arab terror since the very first date of the State of Israel in 1948. And this phenomenon has nothing to do with the situation of occupation in which we are. Now, I know that it might sound surprising that you hear an Israeli diplomat talk about occupation. But this is a term which is employed, generally speaking, and which is quite clear. This is a situation which is not to our liking and which we would like to end by reaching a political solution with the Palestinians on the basis of a Zwei-Staates-Lösung, a two-state solution. One state, the state of Israel, and one state, the state of Palestine. We have been engaged with the Palestinians in a political process for almost 20 years. It's a political process which started in 1993 with the Oslo agreements, and which was supposed, of course, to end much earlier with the creation of a Palestinian state. Unfortunately, we are not there yet, and I'll come to that in a moment. But this is certainly the wish of Israel, of the Israeli side, and I believe that it is also the wish of the Palestinian side, or at least our Palestinian interlocutors, such as the Palestinian Authority. In our long fight against terror, we have been dealing with many different aspects which are related to human rights and human rights violations. First of all, one should understand that, of course, the issue of human rights violations on the Palestinian side is something which is much more part of the public debate. The Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip some 2 years ago was covered by all the media. Those are events which attract a lot of attention. But in parallel, we have been living, we Israelis, a systematic attack on our human rights by the Palestinian side, something which has been less publicized. If we attacked Gaza 2 years ago, it was as a response, as the consequence of many, many years of rocketing and shelling of civilian Israeli cities. Of course, it is not the purpose of Israel to harm the human rights of the Palestinians, but on the other hand, it is our full responsibility to protect our own human rights. And we have to strive and to strike a balance between those two different aspects. When we speak of human rights, we Israelis speak, because this is a question, I don't know whether this is a question that you have discussed here, because we all say human rights, and it's very nice. It's a nice motto, it's a nice slogan. When you say that you are in favor of human rights, you are a wonderful person. But the question is, what are those human rights? Are human rights absolute or relative? And those are big philosophical and legal questions. When we in Israel say human rights, we mean human rights in the same sense in which it is meant in Germany. That is, individual rights and collective rights, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of movement, etc., the same human rights that you talk about. We ask our interlocutors and our adversaries in our region, what is it that you mean by human rights? And the answers that we receive are different and surprising. And sometimes the answers that we receive have nothing to do with our own Western democratic conception of what is it, what are those human rights? And this is also a question which is related to the latest developments in the Arab world. Because what we see in the Arab world is also a revolt against a very particular and very unique definition of what are human rights. I think that what we see in this young generation in the Arab world who is trying to find its expression along democratic lines is really an attempt to become Western and democratic just as you are here. if certain countries believe that they can implement human rights, and by the way, they are also members of the Human Rights Council in Geneva, countries such as Saudi Arabia, in which women are not allowed to drive and cannot work, or countries like Iran, in which people are stoned because they are suspects of adultery, or countries such as Libya and Egypt, in which women are systematically sexually mutilated by an archaic society, then obviously we are not talking about the same human rights. This is why, by the way, this is one of the reasons why I view the developments in the Arab world in a very, very positive way. I'm very optimistic. I don't know whether it will bring about the creation of democratic societies and democratic systems such as we have them in the West, probably not so quickly. But on the other hand, it is certain that the basis for those developments are really the winds of freedom. And this is something which is positive and which should definitely be encouraged. Coming specifically, and I will finish with that, to the Israeli-Palestinian issues. We are struggling with questions without answers. It is easy to sit far away and to give advice. Nothing is easier than to have a cup of coffee on Unter den Linden and to give advice to the whole world. This is wonderful because no matter what happens, you feel good with yourself. If you are right, then this is wonderful. You gave advice and you were right and you feel like the super Resht Haber of the world and everything is wonderful. If you are wrong, nothing happened. So you will have a cup of coffee the next day and you will give another advice to another person. But the dilemmas which people face are extremely complex dilemmas to which there is no right answer. Generally speaking, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a conflict between two rights. It is not a conflict between right and wrong. We are right and they are right, and this is why the only solution is really to reach a political situation, a political solution of sharing and the creation of a Palestinian state along an Israeli state, the state of Israel. But the dilemmas are extremely complex. If you know, for instance, to give you concrete examples, because those are the issues that we have to deal with, those are not theoretical issues. If you know that a group of people have decided to build a bomb, and in order, and that one of them will carry the bomb on his or her body with the intention of blowing himself or herself up in a bus, in a school, in a hospital. And you know that at a certain moment in time, you will not be able to track that person because it is one individual in a huge crowd. And you know that the only way in which you can stop this attack from taking place is by killing this person and by risking the possibility that innocent people will get hurt. This is a dilemma. It's a ticking bomb. This is what we call the ticking bomb dilemma. And there is no good answer. There is no answer with which you can be 100% morally confident. You kill the person, and unfortunately, the bomb that this person carries blows up, and innocent people are killed on the Palestinian side. You do not kill this person, and the person comes into Israel and blows himself or herself up in a bus, and you have 20 dead or 30 dead, as we have lived in the years between 2000 and 2003 or 2004. There are no good answers to those questions. And those are the dilemmas that we are facing. Another dilemma that we are facing, and I know that this is a big issue here in Germany because somehow it is also related to your own history of the Berlin Wall. It is this question of the Sicherheitszaun or the Mauer, the Sicherheitsmauer, the wall or the security obstacle that Israel built between Israel and the Palestinian territories. Of course, it is not pleasant. It is not good. It imposes limitations on freedom. On the other hand, it is a fact, and it is a proven fact, that since this security obstacle was built, Palestinian terrorists no longer blow themselves up in Israel. When you look at the figures, they are dramatic. Since we have this security fence, we do not have suicide bombers in Israel. And again, you have to balance here between an infringement on human rights and the duty, which is the absolute duty of each and every government to protect its own population. I can assure you that if Palestinian suicide bombers no longer blow themselves up in Israel, it is not because they have discovered the light and decided to become Mother Teresa. It is because they simply cannot do it, because physically they do not have the possibility to do it. And here again, those are questions and dilemmas to which there are no good answers. The only good answer, of course, is a political process and a peaceful solution. But until we reach that point, this is where we stand. People who use ambulances in order to transport weapons, and those are issues that you have been dealing with. Hamas activists who use international protection, who use UNRWA schools, schools built by the UN in order to hide ammunition or to shoot rockets at Israeli cities, or who use ambulances in order to transport ammunition or fighters or whatever. People who do not play by the rules. And somehow you have to deal with them by keeping yourself within the rules, but understanding that you are dealing with an opponent or an enemy who doesn't play by the rules. And this is extremely complex. We have no wish to lose our own specificity as a Western, democratic, open, and free society. But our opponent is of a different nature. And this creates a kind of a duality which is extremely complex, which, by the way, has a very negative impact also on the Israeli population. I think that people would be much happier in a situation of peace and freedom and openness as you have it here. It is not particularly pleasant to have, and this is also an infringement on human rights, by the way, to have your bag or your car checked at the entrance of every shopping mall. But it is always better than to allow a person with a bomb to enter the shopping mall and blow himself or herself up. Again, a small dilemma. So I do not come here with answers. I come here with questions, but I simply want to show you a little bit what are the problems that we have to deal with. People forget very quickly. This country has been peaceful and democratic for a very short period of time. 60 years, 70 years, in historical terms, it is not much. Or 20 years for those of you who have lived east of this particular street. It is not a lot of time. And it has come as the consequence of the bloodiest conflicts that humanity has ever known. Compared to which, our own Israeli-Palestinian conflict is nothing. Of course, we have to solve it. We have to solve it for our own good. We do not have to solve it because it would be nice. We have to solve it because it has to do with our own survival as the state of Israel, just as it has to do with the creation of a Palestinian state, which would be wonderful news. I would be very happy to have nice Palestinian neighbors. It would be excellent. It would be good for us. It would be good for them. We have much to give and much to show. Israel is a very developed and modern country, and I think it would be excellent for all sides. But until we are there, we will continue dealing with those dilemmas. Questions of proportionality. If I am in danger, what is the amount of force that I can use in order to stop my opponent, the person who wishes to do harm? All those are questions, again, to which there are no answers. There are no answers. But I'll finish by giving you an example of an event which happened, actually it happened last night. We boarded a ship which came from Syria via Turkey to Egypt carrying Iranian weapons for Hamas. For some, boarding a ship in high sea is piracy. But then this ship, which was filled with weapons, and I think that all the details are in the media, and you can see also the list of weapons, which was meant for Hamas to be used against Israeli civilians. So again, when you measure the price that you pay and the consequences should you not pay the price, I think that the answer is quite clear. And those are decisions that the Israeli government has to take every day. We are a democracy. We elect freely our government. Should the Israeli people not agree with the policy of this or that Israeli government, then of course they are free to change governments, just as it happens here in Germany. But no matter who is the government, we will have to face the same choices and the same dilemmas until we finally manage to reach peace with our neighbors. So I'll end here. It was just a short introduction, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Emmanuel. I think before we come to the questions, we hear Bill, what he has to say about Human Rights Watch's work in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, which is not easy.
Oh, it's very easy.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Minister Nashon has presented us with dilemmas and questions, and I'm delighted to say that I have answers. Well, let me say, the question I'm here to address is, you know, the topic of the discussion is how to protect human rights in conflict zones such as Israel and Gaza. So rather than giving a broad overview, I actually want to do the exact opposite and try and focus in as narrowly as I can on my own experience with this question. So what I'm going to be talking about is my experience reporting on the conflict in Gaza in 2008-2009 and what applies there. And what we think applies are the laws of war, international humanitarian law, and that's where I'm coming from when I say I think I do have some answers to some of these dilemmas. It's looking backwards a bit, but I think it's a conflict, you know, looking back at this 2008-2009 conflict, but it's a conflict that's going to stay with us in several ways. Questions of accountability for violating the laws of war on all sides are still with us. And it's the kind of conflict that we're going to see again, unfortunately, most likely in the region. In other words, non-state armed groups fighting asymmetrical conflicts against Israel while operating from densely populated urban areas, which is a problem that we need to discuss. So I was a part of the research team that Human Rights Watch sent into Gaza immediately after the war. Which is already an important statement. We were not there during the war. We were not able to get in, and that has ramifications for what we can claim. We were not on the ground at the time. On the other hand, our research methodology that we use to cover conflicts around the globe from Yemen to now Libya to Sri Lanka to Chechnya takes this into account. We interview witnesses, multiple witnesses for each event we cover separately, so they can't sort of cross-pollinate their stories. We look at the site of the incident. We try and talk to Israeli soldiers who were involved in the incident, and so on. We won't interview anyone in Gaza, for example, if Hamas is in the room or likely to be able to influence what that person is saying. We realized early on that we could not investigate the entirety of this conflict, so we chose to focus on certain discrete topics, and I just want to narrow in on a few of those to try and clear the air a bit. It's a very controversial area of research. It's something, you know, the Goldstone Report has stirred up all sorts of very strong feelings. So I want to try and bracket the strong feelings and just focus in on a few, you know, discrete things and a few applicable rules that we use. So here are a few of them. We looked at the use of heavy artillery, including high explosive artillery and white phosphorus fired through artillery into Gaza on the Israeli side. And on the Hamas side, we looked at, of course, the use of rockets being fired against Israeli population centers. Now, I've grouped artillery and the rockets together for a reason, which is that they're not particularly accurate weapons. To start with Hamas, they launched hundreds of rockets before, during, and after the conflict, and that's just to, again, bracket it. So during that time frame, we're talking about hundreds of rockets. Some were locally made, called Qassam rockets. Many of these are relatively primitive, but some, you know, they've moved into Qassam phase 4 now, and some of these are relatively more advanced. There are also industrially manufactured Soviet-designed Grad rockets, which have been smuggled into Gaza, and those can reach targets as far away as 40 kilometers or more inside Israel, including major cities like Beersheba, Ashdod, Ashkelon. The thing about rockets is that, unlike missiles, they have no guidance system. They're not particularly accurate. So if you're claiming that you're launching them against a military target, you'd better be sure that there are no civilians anywhere nearby. Because if there are, you cannot in good faith claim that the civilians just accidentally got hurt because I was aiming at the military target. That's ridiculous, but that's exactly what Hamas claimed. They said after the war that they were firing the rockets at military targets, and unfortunately a few mistakes were made. Now, of course, the evidence doesn't bear that out at all. Hundreds of rockets were falling on Israeli population centers where there were no military targets, such as Beersheba. The rockets killed 3 civilians, wounded dozens more. And the issue here is that Hamas is either deliberately, or just recklessly firing the rockets at any target inside Israel. Okay, so that's the one point about the Hamas violations. Now, to compare, let's look at Israel's use of heavy artillery. Heavy artillery is what's called a statistical weapon. It is more accurate than a Hamas-fired rocket, but it's not all that accurate. An artillery shell travels in a huge arc. The artillery was fired from points about 15 kilometers away from its target inside Gaza. And at that distance, if you hit anything that's within 50 meters of what you aimed at, it's considered a perfect hit. But the high explosive artillery shell will kill anything within 125 meters, and it can wound anything within 300 meters. Now, there's no problem with that if you're shooting at something in a relatively open area, if you're shooting at enemy fighters. But if you're using that weapon to attack targets inside a densely populated area like Gaza City, then that's an issue. Israel also used heavy artillery that contained white phosphorus. I'm bringing this up because there's some confusion about this. White phosphorus is not a banned weapon. Okay, it's not illegal per se, and Israel did not use a banned form of white phosphorus in Gaza. It used a form that bursts in the air. The shell does not burst when it hits a target. It bursts in the air, releases a lot of white phosphorus, about 126 little pieces of phosphorus-soaked felt, and these ignite on contact with oxygen and then disperse over an area. And they use that as a smokescreen device. It can either blind the ability of the enemy, in this case Hamas, to see your own forces, or it can just provide a smokescreen behind which your own forces can operate effectively. Now here we come, right, so I've mentioned that this is not a banned weapon. And the reason I say it's not a banned weapon is because the question we address is not which weapons are used. Again, so coming back to the idea of how do you protect human rights in a conflict zone, it's not which weapons are being used, it's how they're being used. And it's not only how are they being used in general. The question you have to ask is, in a specific attack, on this specific location, on this target, on this date, was the use of that weapon, was that attack lawful or not? That's the question you have to ask, and that's why I'm bracketing this in what I hope is not too boring a way. Now, the laws of war give you 2 basic rules that need to apply. The first is that you can only attack a military target. In other words, something that by destroying it gives you a concrete, direct military advantage. You have to be able to distinguish a military target from something that might be civilian. And you have to do a certain amount of preparatory research to identify whether what you're hitting is military or whether it's civilian. Now, this is not a 20/20 hindsight rule. The standard is, what could a reasonably informed military commander have known at the time he or she ordered the attack, in terms of was it a military target or was it a civilian structure? And you also have to use a weapon that could actually hit the thing you're aiming at if you've identified a military target. The second rule follows from this. If you've identified a military target, what is the likely outcome of your attack on it? If the likely outcome of your attack on it is that you're going to kill a million civilians and you're going to wound one enemy soldier, then obviously that would be a disproportionate civilian loss. So we've got the first rule is called distinction. The second rule is proportionality. And that's pretty much the Torah standing on one leg in terms of IHL, in terms of the laws of war. So distinction and proportionality. And here is the criticism. Sorry for the long buildup, but this is the criticism of Israel's use of high artillery, heavy artillery in Gaza. In cases where they were firing heavy artillery shells at Hamas targets inside Gaza City, they could not focus specifically enough on the target. They could hit anything within 50 meters of it if they were lucky, but then they would kill anything within a much larger radius. This is also the problem with white phosphorus. It has very nasty side effects even when it is being used as a smokescreen. So it continues to burn on its way to the ground. If it lands on you, it will burn all the way through your body. It becomes soluble in fat and turns into a poison. The doctors in Gaza couldn't treat it. It would be okay, maybe, if you used it in cases where there were Hamas on the ground and your soldiers were right there and it was an intense conflict. But what we found, looking at individual cases, was that it was often used in places where we couldn't find evidence of any fighting going on. Specifically, just to take one, the only example I'll give you, about 8 a.m. on the morning of January 15th, 2009, the UN field headquarters in Gaza came under attack. They found six white phosphorus shells had landed there and two heavy artillery shells. According to our own investigations and statements by the UN, there were no Hamas fighters in the compound, none immediately nearby. There was fighting going on to the south, but not that close. At the same time, there were 700 civilians seeking shelter in the compound. There were also several tanker trucks filled with highly flammable fuel. By a miracle, no one was killed. By a miracle, none of the fuel tanks were blown up by the white phosphorus, which burns at a temperature of 800 degrees centigrade. That is what we would have a problem with in terms of using heavy artillery in Gaza. Now, let me say we're not making analysis about the overall legality of the Gaza conflict. We are not saying that Israel's use of force overall was disproportionate. If somebody says that Israel's attack on Gaza was disproportionate, that actually doesn't make sense in terms of the laws of war. You can only talk about the proportionality of individual attacks. And that's where I'm coming from. That's the kind of focus that we had for our research, looking at these individual attacks and seeing whether they were focused on a military target and whether, if so, they were proportionate. Now, this leads me to answer, to give my answer to the question of what can be done to protect the human rights of civilians in armed conflict in places like Israel, Gaza, and so on, which is basically that both parties should investigate and hold accountable people who have violated the laws of war. Now, this may sound very strange when you're talking about Hamas. We've said already that Hamas has done nothing to investigate credibly its own forces after Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009. They've given these, you know, ridiculous justifications, like we were aiming at military targets. Nonetheless, and another excuse that's sometimes heard is that Hamas only killed three Israeli civilians. And just to say that, I think you can see the response. Only three human lives. You know, it's not worth investigating because only three human lives were lost. That's ridiculous. But having said all this, Hamas is still susceptible to pressure. Right. Even the killings in Itamar that Minister Nachshon just referenced, the slaughter of five members of a family, Hamas has tried to distance itself from that. They have publicly said that we didn't commit it, we had nothing to do with it. They've also tried to stop rocket fire in the past. They actually tortured 10 members of Islamic Jihad who launched a rocket without permission and forced them to sign little pieces of paper saying, we promise not to launch any more rockets without permission. Of course, they didn't hold them accountable for violating the laws of war. But they want to be seen as abiding by human rights. Human rights is a universal term, and nobody wants to be seen as violating it. So that gives you a certain amount of leverage. Actually, Human Rights Watch has a program of trying to contact elite opinion makers in the Arabic-speaking world to get them to condemn any attack on a civilian, whether that civilian is a Shia or an Israeli or an American or a Sunni, whatever. You should never attack a civilian. Hamas has said they want to uphold human rights, and they are susceptible to pressure like this, and we should continue to work on that. On the Israeli side, there have been some positive steps, which we could see more of if we want to continue to protect civilians. Israel announced it would not use white phosphorus in certain areas after the Gaza conflict. That was the first time they'd used white phosphorus in Gaza, and hopefully it will be the last. They've also created something called humanitarian coordination officers, who will be officers inside the IDF, who should be able to do a better job of identifying where civilians are on the ground so that they're not targeted. And as you may know, Israel also launched scores of investigations into alleged war crimes after the conflict. It's convicted three soldiers of various war crimes since then, and others have been disciplined. Now, the problem from our perspective is that so far only one Israeli soldier has faced any jail time, and that was for stealing a credit card. We don't think that that is enough in terms of either accountability for the victims of the last conflict or enough of a deterrent for future conflicts. And so that's what we'd like to see more of, more actual accountability. Now, both sides here feel at a disadvantage. Hamas says, we only have the rockets. it's the only weapon we have. And here's Human Rights Watch saying that the rockets are unlawful. Hamas will point to the ongoing blockade, to killings of civilians in the buffer zone, and other justifications that could be used for saying, well, we have nothing other than the rockets, and we're going to use them as a reprisal. It doesn't cut it. It is never, ever justified to target a civilian. It's a very simple rule. And Israelis feel that their army took steps to warn civilians in Gaza. They dropped, you know, millions of leaflets. They made phone calls. They put things on the television, on the radio. And that they were forced to fight in an urban environment when civilian casualties are going to be inevitable. But warning civilians doesn't relieve you of your duties to apply the rules of distinction and proportionality. And fighting in an urban environment doesn't relieve you of those duties either. You still have to make your best effort. And what we're talking about is individual cases where it doesn't look like that effort was made and where there hasn't been accountability yet. So what's important to protect human rights in future conflicts? I think the answer is to follow the rules of war. We need to contest claims by anyone who says that these rules do not apply to them, whether because of the justness of their cause or the weakness of their weapons or the asymmetrical nature of their conflict or the existential threat that they may feel that they're operating under. We need to make it clear that human rights and the laws of war are apolitical and non-negotiable. Thanks.